I was just feeling pretty good about the whole thing when I felt someone pull my .45 from the back of my jeans and place a hand on my shoulder. He shouted over the thunder of the locomotive and the rattle of the rails, "Stick 'em up!" When I got to the steel grating, I turned with my hands up, only to find John Saunders with a smile in my sidearm. "This is about to fall out of your pants, so I grabbed it." He stared at me, taking in the scarf over my face, and then motioned toward the naturally heated cab. "Come on!" I followed him into the nerve center of the big steam locomotive, where it must have been 90 degrees. I pulled my collar down along with the scarf and looked at both of them. Roback stared at me. "Jesus, where'd he come from?"
"Over the top, can you believe it? What the hell for?"
I turned toward the engineer.
"Were there two sheriffs up here recently?"
Saunders glanced at his buddy and then back to me.
"There hasn't been anybody here but us since we left Evanston. Why?"
I thought about where the two men could have gone, but couldn't come up with anywhere else. Maybe they had only stepped forward to talk privately in the space between cars. I saw two men coming from this direction and made an assumption, something I shouldn't have done. I'd started to step forward when my boot landed on something and my foot skittered out from under me. Saunders bent and picked up a very large box-end wrench and handed it to Roback.
"You don't secure that thing, we're going to lose it, or worse."
The brakeman slipped the 2-foot wrench under his bench seat.
"That pre-valve keeps loosening, and I get tired of dragging the toolbox out. Don't worry, I'll keep it under here."
Saunders turned back to me.
"Well, it must have been something mighty important for you to make the trip like you did."
He studied me.
"If you don't mind my asking, and even if you do, Deputy, what's going on back there?"
"We've got one man murdered, and another missing."
"I know we're supposed to stop somewhere near Fort Fred Steele to pick up a body, but nobody said anything about him being murdered."
"Well, it's yet to be verified."
"And one missing?"
"Yep." He glanced at the frozen terrain screaming by.
"You got a man missing. He's not on this train."
"My thoughts exactly."
He eyed me. "That's a hell of a state of things on a train full of sheriffs."
I peeled my gloves off and thrust them toward the engine's gigantic boiler. "Have you guys heard or seen anything out of the ordinary on the trip?"
"You mean other than what you've already mentioned?"
"Nope." Saunders glanced at Roback.
"You?"
"Nope. How could I? I've been here with you the whole time." The engineer turned back to me.
"I'll be just as happy when this little excursion is over, though, I'll tell you."
I nodded. "Only a couple of hours to go, huh?"
"Maybe."
I pulled my hands back and flexed some movement into them. "Oh, now why do I not like the sound of that?" He shrugged and stuck his hand out the window like a kid in a car.
"The snow is already piling up on Elk Mountain, and if we don't get through there before the rails fill up, we might be there till spring."
"Great." I studied the rear of the cab and the tender, which was already coated with ice.
"Is there any other way back?"
"Nope." I slipped my gloves on and tugged my hat down again.
"So you guys have to climb over that thing every time you want to get in touch with the rest of the train?"
"No." He reached over and plucked a mic from a radio set above.
"We've got a radio system that runs to every car."
"Of course you do." I pulled the scarf up over my face.
"Well, keep up the speed. I'd just as soon not spend the night on Elk Mountain. We're doing a strong 80. Any faster than that in this weather and we're liable to derail."
"Don't do that either." Checking to make sure I shoved the Colt deep in the back of my jeans, I hoisted myself onto the ladder and started up, comforted by the fact that I wasn't bucking a headwind this time around. At the top of the tender, I looked down at the segmented Pullman cars and felt like I was looking at the different parts of my life. I wasn't sure of what I was doing, but I was pretty sure I knew why, and the cupola of the caboose looked to be a long way away. Vic crossed her arms and leaned back on Katie's kitchen counter.
"You seem restless."
"I am."
She nodded to herself. "Let's go shoot somebody."
"You think that'll make me feel better?"
"Works for me."
I turned and glanced at my mentor, granddaughter, and guardian all asleep in the living room. Those three seemed to be hitting it off.
"That's because they all share napping as a favorite hobby. Personally, I like a little more action."
Henry came in from the porch and pulled out a chair. "What are you two plotting?" "Muscular, with blonde hair." Vic turned to look at me.
"What?"
"Our homeless friend, he said
the guy who threw the rock through my window, was muscular and blonde. Who have we met that matches that description? They both looked at me blankly. Would you describe that Coulter fellow who was with Alexia's nephew as muscular and blonde? I looked around. Speaking of Alexia, where is she?
Katie says she did not show up today, but that yesterday she had mentioned something about her nephew.
He said it, Vic, and then me.
You are circling the wagons?
I stared at the big Indian.
That phrase coming from you is inordinately unsettling.
Would you like to call her?
Vic pointed at the utility. There's a phone with a cord, but it is non-rotary. Do you need me to push the buttons for you?
Thanks, but no thanks.
Just to show her, I dialed the number from the address book on the counter. It rang, but there was no answer. I hung up, noted the Mendes address, and decided to go for a drive. I'm making a house call.
You want company?
Well, I usually prefer to do my wild goose chasing solo. She ignored me and started toward the door.
I'm going with you.
You coming, Henry?
He looked at me, dark eyes sparkling.
If you are right and something is on, I will do better to stay here.
I nodded and headed down to the Bullet. I looked for Peter Lowry, but he didn't seem to be around. Vic leaned forward.
Nice windshield.
It's remarkably clean, isn't it?
Vic put the address into her magic phone, and we discussed the case as I headed south on Business 25, then looped over the railroad tracks and under the interstate. Taking a right onto Fox Farm Road, just before it turned, I drove into a quasi-residential neighborhood where there were a few run-down houses overlooking the highway.
So if I get on that road, it'll take me to Philadelphia?
In 24 hours. I cast an eye her way. Missing home? She made a face. That patrolman in Pine Bluff, Mittenbuehler? He reminded me of Michael in some odd way. My breath caught a little in my throat as I thought about her murdered brother and how gentle she'd been with the Pine Bluff patrolman who'd almost killed me. I reached out and squeezed her hand, but she turned away. There were no numbers on the small houses, but I recognized Alexia's white Chevrolet in one of the driveways, so I parked behind it and we got out. There was a low chain-link fence, but I didn't see any dogs, so I let us in. As I passed a Chevy, I placed a hand on the hood out of habit, but it held no trace of warmth. Marching up to the door like a census taker, with Vic close behind, I gave a smart rap on the storm door, and we stood there and waited. I knocked a few more times and then wished I'd brought Henry along so that we could have done a proper reservation search warrant. Glancing up and down the road, I turned to Vic and was about to open the door when a Cheyenne police unit turned the corner and slowed upon seeing my truck emblazoned with the Absaroka County Sheriff's Department stars. Attempting to seem nonchalant, I waved, but he stopped and his window went down. He was young, with the ubiquitous aviator sunglasses.
"How you doing, Sheriff?"
"I'm good. How about you?"
"What are you up to?"
"Breaking into this house," I said, following the best, if not the official, policy. He nodded.
"Can I help?"
I smiled.
"Might lend some credibility to the act."
He parked, and the smartly uniformed officer joined us on the small porch.
"Nico Severini,
Walt Longmire, and this is my undersheriff, Victoria Moretti." He nodded to her and then looked back at me.
"You've been in the papers a lot lately."
He then added in a loud voice,
"We got a call about some noise."
"Really?" He looked at me with more than a note of incredulity and then lowered his voice for a response.
"No."
He reached past me and knocked on the interior door.
"Cheyenne Police Department, hello?"
I watched him turn the knob, the door opening just a bit. He spoke loudly again. "The door seems to be ajar, which I find suspicious. How about you?"
Vic answered loudly, "Absolutely, officer."
I pushed open the door.
"You going in?"
"Anything to get out of the Campbell Soup Playhouse." We all unsnapped and withdrew our weapons as I pushed the door the rest of the way open.
"Hello?"
There was no answer. I glanced around the front room where nothing seemed to miss.
"Alexia?"
There was still no answer, so I stepped inside, sweeping the corners and advancing toward the narrow hallway
that I guessed would lead past the kitchen and through the house, shotgun style. It was also empty, as were the bathroom and two bedrooms. The storm door in the back was closed, but I moved down the hall and looked through the glass toward the edge of the hillside and the highway beyond. I turned to Vic and Severini and stated the more than obvious. There's no one here. Vic glanced around. But her car's out front. Severini rested his hand on his sidearm. Who lives here? My granddaughter's nanny. Well, I can see how that would be an emergency. She didn't show up for work and didn't call. She always calls. Anywhere else she might be? Any other numbers we can phone? Friends? Relatives? She's got a nephew, a Ricardo Mendez, who lives here, but I don't know his cell number or even where he works. She also mentioned a David Coulter, a friend of his, but I know even less about him. Do you have somebody you can call? I can call my daughter. She works with the Attorney General. He smirked. Well, might lend some credibility to the act.
They're slowing the train to pick up Marv Leland's body.
Attempting to clear my head, I sat up in my bunk and looked at Lucian standing in the doorway of our compartment in his battered B-3 flight jacket. How long have I been out?
Couple of hours.
I swung my legs onto the floor and scrubbed my face with my hands. Why didn't you wake me up?
I just did.
I mean earlier. He gestured toward the darkening landscape through the window.
What, you wanted to see the scenery? The damn train's been running at a good 80 miles an hour, and so there hasn't been anybody getting on or off, and there haven't been any big breaks in the case as near as I can tell.
I stood and steadied myself. Well, then, how come you didn't take a nap?
I napped in a booth in the dining car.
He gestured toward the rear and started off with me in tow.
They say they're going to need some help loading the casket in. And you'd be amazed how many bad backs suddenly pop up at a time like this.
I bet. I locked the door to the cabin. And nothing else has happened?
There aren't any more dead sheriffs, if that's what you're asking.
That's a relief. I stooped and glanced out the windows at the blowing snow.
If you're looking at the weather, it's shitty, with a chance of shittier.
Are we going to make Elk Mountain? Just then the train slowed substantially, and I threw out a hand to steady myself.
We might make it there, but I'm not so sure we'll make it over.
As we moved through the dining car, I could see Gibbs along with some of the other kitchen personnel putting things away in the galley, and he joined us on the far end, wiping his hands on an apron. I put some food in the refrigerator for you, Mr. Longmire. The sheriff here said you were asleep, but I thought you might get hungry before the night is over.
Thanks, Mr. Gibbs.
He followed us.
You should hang on to every scrap of food you've got just in case we get snowed in up on the pass.
Oh, we got plenty of food. There's no worry in that.
We walked through the last connection between the dining car and the caboose, the real bite of the storm blowing between the cracks and through the gaps in the moving metal floor. Inside the caboose, my greatest hits were assembled. The security guy, Joe Holland, and sheriffs Inda, Brown, Tillman, and Phelps. Tillman smoked a cigarette between clenched teeth.
Have a nice nap this time in your own cabin?
I nodded. Goes with a clear conscience. We all bundled ourselves up as the train continued to slow. Brown, who was closest to the door, pulled at his hat as the train ground to an agonizingly slow stop.
Let's go. The engineer says we've got only 15 minutes. If we don't get him on here in that amount of time, we're going to be chasing a train in a snowstorm while carrying a pine box.
Four of us followed him, waiting as Gibbs, the only brains in the outfit, reached out and unhooked the chain that ran across the back railing. Lucian stayed behind on the platform. A late-50s Cadillac hearse from a Carbon County mortuary was backed up to the crossing, where the arms were down, blocking the road. The caddy blinked red, along with the lights and the accompanying klaxons screamed a warning. Stomping across the snow, embedding the cinders and ash into our footsteps, we stood at the back of the hearse while an attendant and the Carbon County Sheriff opened the door. The wind was blowing hard, the snow sticking to the side of my face. The other men hesitated, so I stepped up and took hold of one of the cheap metal handles on the side and started pulling.
Come on, let's go. It's cold out here. And the train is going to leave without us if we don't hustle.
They all looked a bit shocked, but it jarred them into motion. Without looking back, I started walking toward the train. I was certainly an expert at carrying bodies, and in that moment, I began to wonder if the stench of death was really what was chasing everything I cared about away from me. When we reached the platform, Lucian and Gibbs did the best they could, dragging the oblong box into the caboose, but weren't making much headway. I quickly climbed the side steps, grabbed the two front handles, and pulled Marv Reland into the train for his last ride. By the time I got the coffin situated, the others had gotten back on, and no sooner had they done so than the steel wheels began to roll toward Elk Mountain. I'd started to stand when somebody pushed me hard against the wall of the caboose. Catching myself, I whirled around to find John Schaefer spitting with rage. "You tried to search my room?" Rearing up to my full height, I looked down at him, and his hand automatically slipped to his side. "Yep, I searched your room and found all those nifty little trophies from the newspapers you've got tucked away in your suitcase. And if you go to pull that revolver at your side, I'm going to push the thing down your ever-loving throat and pull the trigger till I hear it click." He had the good sense to believe me because his arm went slack. "I keep those clippings to remind me of what my brother did and why I did what I had to do." He puffed himself up for more and pointed a finger at the coffin. "I still think you had something to do with this man's death, if not the disappearance of George McKay." He didn't sound all that convinced, but threw in a bit more to make it stick. "I need a drink, but if you touch that coffin while I'm gone, I'll see you hang, tough guy." They filed out after giving me hard looks, but I'd had hard looks thrown at me before, and had found they bounced off pretty easily. I stretched my neck muscles and tried to unclench my jaw, but the pain in the back of my head wasn't giving up, and I was beginning to think that my unconscious was hammering out a message in Morse code to the frontal lobe. Gibbs and Sheriff Connolly were still standing there, sadly studying the cheap pine box. Lucian shook his head, unzipped his fleece-lined flak jacket, and pulled out his flask. "Well, boy, I am here to tell you that you sure haven't been making friends and influencing people on this trip, Sheriff Connolly. I mean, if you've got anybody on your side in this train other than me and Gibbs here, Sheriff Connolly," he gestured toward the coffin, "excluding obvious company, Lucian." He finally stopped and cocked his head at me. What, for God's sake?" I kneeled down and ran a hand across the wet, rough grain of the wooden planks where the snow was melting, and then pushed my hat back and stared at the two of them. "How much did Marv Leland weigh?" As we walked out of the house, I stopped and stood there on the porch, that niggling feeling running up and down my spine. Vic glanced back at me. "Do you smell what I smell?" I went back in the house, stood in the living room, and sniffed. It was faint, but there was a metallic smell that grew stronger as I approached the hallway and the back door. The button on the latch was broken, and I pushed the door wide, stepped onto the concrete stoop, and looked around. There was a picnic table that had seen better days, and an open space next door where a gigantic billboard sat, crouched on the hill above the interstate highway, advertising Brian Scott's morning radio show on K2. There was a breeze coming from the west, and I walked in that direction. It was a smell I'd encountered many times before, and not a pleasant one. There was a low chain-link fence between me and the weedy field where the billboard stood, through which I could see a blue tarp rolled up in the weeds at the base of the sign. Vic and the Cheyenne patrolman hopped the fence and followed me as I walked toward the sign, with the face of the Voice of Wyoming looking down at me, a hand over his mouth, almost as if he were surprised to find me there. The tarp had been expertly tied with a nylon rope, the kind that was used for clotheslines, but the outline was unmistakable, even without the blood seeping from one end. I kneeled down by the body and measured the size against the dimensions in my head as Vic stood a step away. "It's not her, but it's somebody." Severini's voice sounded over my shoulder. "You'd better not touch anything." I slipped my knife from my back pocket. "I'm cutting this one piece of rope just so I can see the face." "I wouldn't do that. We can get DCI over here in a matter of minutes." "I'm here now, and I need to know who this is." Vic stepped between us, and he didn't say anything more. I unlocked the blade and slipped it under the loop nearest the head. The tarp flapped in the breeze, and I reached into my coat pockets for my gloves putting them on and carefully drawing the plastic away. It was Ricardo, Alexia's nephew. Pulling the tarp back a bit more, I could see where his throat had been viciously cut almost halfway through. I replaced the tarp over his face. He's the nephew of the woman I'm looking for. I reached a hand out to Vic. Can I borrow your phone again? She handed it over, and I dialed Katie's house number. Henry picked up after two rings.
Longmire residence.
It's me. Have you heard or seen anything from Alexia?
No. We thought you were going to her house.
I did. I found her nephew. Somebody killed him.
There was a brief pause.
No sign of her?
No.
What do you want us to do?
Stay there with my granddaughter, and I'll call Katie. Something is going on. The line went dead, and I dialed Katie's number at work. Wyoming Attorney General's office. This is Sheriff Walt Longmire. I'd like to speak to my daughter, Katie Longmire. Just a moment, please. She put me on hold, and then the phone rang. And rang. And rang. Hello, this is Katie Longmire. Katie. The recording continued unabated. I'm not available to answer your call right now. I hung up and hit redial, and the same woman answered. Wyoming attorney, hey, it's Walt Longmire again. Katie's not in her office. The woman sounded slightly annoyed. Okay. Can you look around and see if you can find her? Mr. Longmire, she began, in a tone of voice that made it clear that she had far better things to do than anything I requested. Sheriff Longmire. I'm sure she's just stepped away from her desk, or maybe she's gone out to lunch. Is this an emergency? Ma'am, I am kneeling over a dead body about 2 miles from your office, and I need to talk to my daughter right now. That got her attention.
Yes, sir.
I'll see if I can find her. Will you hold?
Yep.
As I waited, I watched Severini talking into his body mic. Then he called over to me. DCI and the mystery mobile will be here in a few minutes. He nodded toward the body. Did you know him? Vic and I shared a glance. Yes, well, I met him once. My eyes went back to the tarp. He played guitar.
Sheriff Longmire?
I turned the phone back to my ear. Yep?
It's just as I thought. She's out to lunch.
Where?
Well, I really couldn't say.
She quickly added. One of my co-workers who was at the front desk said she left with a nice young man, a David Coulter. Chapter 15. Looking for a hammer and a chisel in the toolbox underneath the cot, the first thing I noticed was that Gibbs's spare boots and coveralls weren't in there. I found the tools, which looked as if they might have been left over from the Transcontinental Railway days, but I decided not to say anything about the missing clothing. I nudged the toolbox over a little and sat on it as I wedged the business end of the wood-handled chisel between the lid and the coffin itself, gently tapping the edge of the tool inward with the hammer.
What in the hell do you suppose you're going to find in there?
I glanced up at my boss. Like I said before, how much do you think Marv Leland weighed?
Hell if I know. 160 or so, give or take.
I looked at the cook. Mr. Gibbs, you tried to move this box. Did it feel like it weighed 160 pounds? He didn't answer right away.
Maybe it's the box, sir.
I shook my head and hammered the chisel, using it to gradually pry the top open. The track repair crew said they found a man missing an arm on the side of the tracks near Fort Fred Steele, right? Lucian nodded.
Yeah.
I popped the lid up enough to where I could get my fingers underneath, and then yanked. We weren't rewarded with a body, per se, but rather something I'd seen entirely too much of in the last few years. And we all looked down at the heavy-duty, rubberized black fabric with the carry loops and single zipper. An HRP, a human remains pouch, a body bag. I guess the U.S. government had a surplus. For a moment, I felt like I was falling backward, when really I was frozen in place, and even though I was aware of everything in the caboose, I couldn't move.
Mr. Longmire, sir?
Lucian's voice called from far away.
Walt?
They used to use cotton mattress covers. Sheriff Connolly looked at me strangely.
Come again?
In the old days, they used to use mattress covers, but they decided that they needed something that was leak-proof. We used them for carrying and storing everything when I was...
when I was over there. Ammo, rations, medical supplies. Lucian looked me in the eye. You all right? I took a deep breath. Yep. I'm okay. Sorry. You sure you're all right? I nodded. The crew said they found a man missing an arm, not a one-armed man. I leaned over and unzipped the bag, plainly revealing the bloodied face of Sheriff George McKay. Even with an entire limb missing, he'd easily outweigh Leland.